The world is full of magic and wonder, if you know where to look. And I'm obsessed with looking for it. I'm Simon Sinek, and I host a podcast called A Bit of Optimism. Each week, I have a short conversation with someone who inspires me or teaches me something about life, leadership, and other curious things. I hope you'll join me on the journey. Listen to A Bit of Optimism on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
I am so excited about this podcast, The Bright Side. You guys are giving people a chance to shine a light on their lives, shine a light on a little advice that they want to share.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
Every family has an origin story, one passed down through the generations. Mine happens to be a mystery involving my great-great-grandmother left behind in Sicily. I'm Joe Piazza, and my new podcast will transport you to the gorgeous island of Sicily as I trace my roots back through a whodunit for the ages. Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Play is learning. Playing with each other, learning how to balance on blocks, building things, watching it crash over because, wow, it was so high. These are all how we learn.
On this episode of the Psychology Podcast, I had a delightful chat with Yumi Kendall, assistant principal cellist of the Philadelphia Orchestra. Yumi began studying cello at the age of 5, following the Suzuki method, and at age 16, she made her solo debut at the Kennedy Center with the National Symphony Orchestra. Yumi is a very multifaceted, thoughtful, and creative human. In this episode, we discuss her experiences in Waldorf education, classical music's role in human flourishing and creating a feeling of awe and transcendence, and her interests surrounding organizational flourishing more generally. We also discuss her life-changing experience as a mom and the development of her talent over the years. Yumi and I have something very special in common that I want to share with you all. Both of our grandfathers are the reason we learned how to play the cello. And in fact, her chair in the Philadelphia Orchestra is the same exact chair my grandfather, Harry Gordetzer, occupied in the Philadelphia Orchestra for 50 years before her. So Yumi and I clearly have this very special bond, and I'm so excited to shine the spotlight on her today. So without further ado, I bring you Yumi Kendall. Yumi, how the heck are you?
It's great to be with you. Thank you so much for having me.
great to reconnect. We are going to talk everything good and beautiful today.
That sounds like a plan. I still remember that first day at the Positive Psychology Center for me and realizing that your grandfather was a connection. That was amazing.
Well, there's an interesting connection there in multiple levels. At one level, you currently hold the chair in the Philadelphia Orchestra that my grandfather held for 50 years.
It's amazing. I can't believe it.
He's the last one that was hired by Stokowski and Normandy. Together, they were in the same room together. So Stokowski's last audition.
Wow.
and then he was in Fantasia, the movie, the original Fantasia movie.
Wow.
Yeah, he was a graduate of Curtis. Yeah, I went through Eugene Normandy and then Riccardo Muti, who was a good friend of the family. And so there's that amazing connection that you currently hold. You hold that chair. You're carrying on the torch in a beautiful, beautiful way. And then you're carrying on the torch of my grandma. And then secondly, it turns out as I'm reading deeper into your work that both of our grandfathers are the reason why we both play cello. I play cello too, not to the extent you do, but both of our grandfathers are responsible. Mm. So can you tell me a little bit about your grandfather and how he influenced you?
Because I think
there's just multiple grandfather levels here.
It's amazing to have those family connections both between us, of course, and within my own family. And of course, we can't help who we're born to. So it's just good luck on my end that I feel this way. My American grandfather John Kendall is largely credited with introducing the Suzuki method of music education to the Americas back in the 1960s. And he, of course, my Japanese grandfather had no idea about classical music in Japan, like in the rice fields, and no electricity until I think I was 12 or 13. And it was no running water until I was, until we were visiting. So really beautiful contrasts in life, in our family backgrounds. Grandfather, American grandfather, John Kendall, was always a violin pedagogue and saw a video of several hundred violinists all playing, Japanese violinists, little ones to teenagers playing all together a violin concerto. And he couldn't believe, these teachers could not believe that, that what they were seeing was actually happening. Mm. And they thought, oh gosh, 90% of them, they must be ringers. They're not actually playing. They're just leaning on the 5 or 10 folks who are actually playing their hearts out. And they, this contingent of teachers flew over to Japan to investigate, is what we saw on this video actually happening?
Is it a magic trick?
Is it a magic trick? Right. And it, in fact, all of these children were actually playing and well. And so that, that was from the Suzuki, a Suzuki conference or a group session that was being toured around the U.S. That was what they saw. And so that's how grandfather got connected to the Suzuki education and then to Shinichi Suzuki himself. And Suzuki education started in Japan post-World War II. Suzuki believed that if all children learn how to make a beautiful tone, they will also have beautiful hearts. And this was partly in the aftermath of the traumas of the of World War II, at least on the Pacific front for Suzuki in Japan, and the atrocities and the traumas, and a humanitarian kind of belief that music can make us beautiful people. And that every child can. In fact, that is the prerequisite course for Suzuki teacher trainers, which I took in my teacher training. Before you can even take the teacher training, there is a course every teacher in training must take called Every Child Can. And that is the innate belief that every child has potential.
And I love that so much.
So, yeah, I mean, this is your world, right? This is all you, Scott.
No, I'm just saying that should be the title of my next book. I love that.
It's a really beautiful concept, a beautiful world. And when it's applied well, the Suzuki method of education, when the approach is applied well, it is, you know, it's not intended to create child prodigies. It's intended to create citizens of the world who know how to play music, who appreciate music, who beauty and creating beauty and effort.
So there's so much more to Suzuki method. You know, it as you just illustrated in like a couple minutes, you know, there's so much greater depth to Suzuki method than I think what comes immediately to mind for people. So that is really helpful, immensely helpful. I started on Suzuki method with violin.
Oh,
when I was two or three.
Two? Were you even in like out of diapers?
Yeah,
I have a 3-year old, so that's why I'm asking. So she's not yet.
I think my second birthday, my grandfather got me a violin for my birthday. You know, it's just, I don't have that many memories of the Suzuki, you know, fleeting memories, but so it can be really helpful. Your own education path was unique. You were in Waldorf education, which I really think, must have influenced you and the way you see the world and your playfulness and your creativity and your spirit. Can you tell me a little bit about what is Waldorf system?
Waldorf education is, it started early last century in Germany, Austria, by Rudolf Steiner. And it is now a worldwide movement, much like Suzuki is. And it is about educating the whole person. We don't have tests. We don't have anything extrinsic motivators. It's about, at least in early childhood, play is learning. Playing with each other, learning how to balance on blocks, building things, watching it crash over because, wow, it was so high. These are all how we learn. And it was so interesting for me when I went through MAP at Penn for positive psychology and hearing one of the presenters talk about positive education and how the data is showing how effective positive education is. Yeah. And all of the criteria and parameters for that. It was very, very similar to Waldorf education. And the problem, quote unquote, problem with Waldorf education is because it doesn't test, at least in the lower school through the first 8 grades, there are no formal tests. There is no data to show how successful it is as compared to another group because it understands the approach of education understands that creativity and play and letting children learn at their own pace in their own environment with each other, of course, in the social structure that is part of the school, meaning there is social network, it's not in isolation. We know from experience, I knew from experience how wonderful my childhood was because of my Suzuki and Waldorf educations. And the problem with the Waldorf education was that it wasn't being measured because that's not part of the education system is measuring those things. So it was like an intrinsic problem. And I loved seeing this presenter at school at Penn doing this presentation because it just validated everything from a data perspective of my experience of my positive experience with Waldorf education. Let's see. I think there were 3 tiers we learned at the end of senior year. The first sort of tier is children learn through their senses. We learn through feeling our sense of we're taking in the world through our senses. And so soft, beautiful textures, natural fibers, wood, beautiful craftsmanship, soft cloth and rainbow cloth and all of the texture and sight and sound and smell, like the baking that happens in kindergarten that we all get to bake and roll the dough together and smell the bread as it's baking while you're going to go outside and play it sounds very idyllic and it is. The belief is that children first learn through their senses. The next phase more through elementary school is that we learn through our hearts, through our sense of goodness and through our innate sense of human kindness. And then in high school, we learn more cerebrally, more cognitively, and become more the complete sort of thinking, the whole person, through the goodness in our sort of hearts, as we've hopefully been established in the younger years. But that's why the whole Waldorf education is about teaching the whole or cultivating the whole person. It's not about teaching like putting things in and you regurgitate correct facts out. It's about cultivating, like watering a plant.
Makes sense. Yeah, I really like that approach. Well, so you started playing when you were 5. Chell, you know, there's a term in psychology that Howard Gardner coined called a crystallizing experience. A lot of people who are very creative, they can point to a crystallizing an experience where they encountered something and they're like, oh wow, this is me. This is what I want to do moving forward. Yo-Yo Ma passed. I believe he passed. When he saw a cello in a window and he's like, ah, cello. You know, Jacqueline Dupre heard it on the radio and she's like, oh, I want to play that instrument. Mm. Did you have a crystallizing experience?
My crystallizing experience, I'll tell two anecdotes. The first one is I did not have a young age crystallizing experience because my whole childhood was surrounded by family playing music. Right. Doesn't every family play like string quartets with the second violin subbed out for French horn at the holidays gatherings. And doesn't everybody sing four-part harmony carols or even get neighbors together to sing versions of Handel Messiah? You know, doesn't everybody do that? Isn't this normal?
Perfectly normal.
So I had my older brother plays violin. He's in Nick Kendall. He's in a group called Time for Three. Hmm. I have an older cousin who is principal viola of the National Symphony. His dad, my uncle, was second chair of viola of the National Symphony Orchestra at the Kennedy Center. My grandfather. I have an uncle who is in the arts, performing arts world as well. And everybody plays or participates in music in the family, in my American family, somehow. So at holiday gatherings and birthday parties, and we were all in the same area, and it was just normal for us to participate in music.
Beautiful.
And so as an invite for me, children, you know, children are a mirror of their environments, and that's a Suzuki sort of philosophical belief that we will learn by imitation and positive encouragement and repetition. That triumvirate is like one of the main teaching tenets in music in Suzuki. And so for that imitation, of course I wanted to do what my family was doing because that's what I see. So my turn came when I was 5 and Grammy and grandfather had a pawn shop cello under their piano. And that became my cello. It was my Aunt Nancy's cello when she was a little girl. And they just kept it. And it became my cello. And so there was a sense of family connection, although I was not aware of it at the time. I just knew I would get to start advancing instead of playing from cereal boxes with little rubber bands attached to it to pretend to participate in making music. I would get to play this cello that was from a pawn shop that was Aunt Nancy's.
What was it, like a 1/16th?
Maybe so. Phoebe, my daughter's right now is a 1/10th, and she's 3. Yeah. So it might have been more like a 1/8th. But, you know, it's all like jumbo size cereal box size with a pin stuck in the bottom. So
exactly. I'm super interested in the development of expertise. I mean, this is I'm obsessed with this topic and its interaction with talent. I think talent matters. I mean, I think that people who want to say there's no such thing as talent are blind. But the idea of what does talent mean? You know, what does that really look like when you really dissect it? I think that's a really interesting question. So some people do get more bang for their buck out of particular things, particular training regimens. Kobe Bryant got a pretty good bang for his buck with basketball, you know, that others would not get the same bang for their buck for, you know. You got a great bang for your buck with the cello, you know. But can you describe to me your first person experience about the acceleration of that curve and you know, what it was experientially like for you to work your way up to the Philadelphia Orchestra?
Well, I can say that first of all, the Philadelphia Orchestra is called the Destination Orchestra in much the same way you've described it. Like, once if you've been validated and being accepted by a jury of your peers, meaning other musicians, you know, you're going to be okay. You're good to go. But I can say, I'll give a couple of moments that when I was a teenager, and I definitely put in the whatever 10,000 hours by the time I was 15 or so, I remember this passage in Shostakovich's first cello concerto on the second to last page that has a very fast 30-second notes with scales and thumb position, each one slightly different than the previous. Very, very challenging. And it was the first time in my cello playing experience ever that I cried. I was so frustrated because I did not know how to overcome that challenge. Yeah. It was the first time that I was so challenged. I didn't know how, like, I know I had work ethic. I know I had repetition. I knew how to practice. I knew how to break things down so that I could work them back up again at tempo, in different patterns, in different permutations and backwards and forwards, the slurs, articulations, all these different techniques that I knew of from my grandfather, actually, practice techniques that he would call unit practice. And that was the first time I was so frustrated. I felt like, I don't know if I can do this.
Yeah.
And that was very good for me to go through that, to have that humbling experience. Eventually, the perseverance just kicked in. I just had to believe in myself that I would get it. And I did. I performed it. It went fine. But it took longer than my previous iterations of typical practicing had taken. And that was very good for me to go through that, because I realized I really have to try. I mean, I was already trying. But before that point, and even after that point, I had what I refer to as just lots of green lights. I'm so fortunate to have had the tools with a cello under my grandparents' piano, to have had lessons, which take financial resources from my grandparents, it happens to be, and opportunities. And that those opportunities were green lights for me. It didn't matter if I won second or first prize, but they were performance opportunities that helped me grow. And all of those opportunities from, you know, age five or like six, my first recital, to up through winning the Philadelphia Orchestra job, and since then, which I won my orchestra job 20 years ago in 2004. All of those are not just about having the tools and the lessons, it's about having the opportunities to challenge myself in those competitions or recitals, low key, big key, small town to big national things. They're all growth opportunities. That's another thing I'd love to chat with you about, Scott, about increasing those opportunities for everybody, because access to beautiful music and learning how to make beautiful music is for everybody. It's a part of the human experience. But anyway, the second story I wanted to actually tell you about as well was I did not decide to go into music until the day after my SATs in senior year.
As the number one audio company, iHeartMedia gives you access to all. Every audience, live conversations, trusted influencers, and the insights and data you need to grow. iHeartMedia is your access company. Go to iHeartResults.com for more.
I'm preaching to somebody today who is waiting for God to give you your next step. And you don't know what it is yet. You need God to show you your next step. Because God, I can't stay where I am, like I am, where it is. This isn't going to work. I have to move on, but I don't know where. A lot of time you'll use it as an excuse. Well, I don't know how, I don't know where, I don't know what. God, if you show me, God, if you tell me, God, no. You know enough right now. And if you needed to know more, he would show you.
Hey, this is Stephen Furtick. I want to invite you to listen to my podcast, Elevation with Stephen Furtick. I am here to help you for the battles that you face in life, for the times when you feel discouraged, for the times that you need guidance from God. I want to give you the truth of what he says about you to help you rise to your full potential. Listen to Elevation with Stephen Furtick every Sunday and Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Get emotional with me, Radhi Devlukia, in my new podcast, A Really Good Cry. We're going to talk about and go through all the things that are sometimes difficult to process alone. We're going to go over how to regulate your emotions, diving deep into holistic personal development, and just building your mindset to have a happier, healthier life. We're going to be talking with some of my best friends.
I didn't know we were going to go there on this.
People that I admire.
When we say listen to your body, really tune into what's going on.
Authors of books that have changed my life.
Now you're talking about sympathy, which is different than empathy, right?
And basically have conversations that can help us get through this crazy thing we call life.
I already believe in myself. I already see myself. And so when people give me an opportunity, I'm just like, oh, great, you see me too.
We'll laugh together, we'll cry together, and find a way through all of our emotions. Never forget, it's okay to cry as long as you make it a really good one. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Radhi Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What did you think you were going to be?
I didn't know. The green lights. I had a biology teacher who was like, Yumi, you should go to med school or whatever, become a, you know, I was interested in studying the brain. I did a brain project in high school in Waldorf, right? Like my PE teacher wanted me to do track and field because I was very fast. Just a very good sprinter. I did not have the patience for a marathon, but I'm a very good sprinter. And sort of naturally jumpy. and, you know, I had different teachers in Eurythmy, which is a sort of movement, spiritual related movement, almost dance with music, classical music. I had very supportive teachers who were encouraging me to quote unquote go into their genre, study deeply in their arena, in their field. And I loved all of that. And so I didn't decide to go to take auditions for music school until the day after my SATs, when my friends and I were discussing what at the time was personal essays for entrances, exams or entrance applications. And I was struggling with what my personal essay content would be. And that's when I realized, oh, music. That's my personal story. That's how I tell my story is through music. And it all made sense then. And then then I changed from doing homework first to practicing to then doing practicing first and then my homework. And that wasn't until senior year. So I had many green lights. When I talk about green lights in music with the competitions and the recital opportunities and family recital opportunities, when it's just a very safe space with people who love you no matter what. And it's just a chance to have fun with friends playing. We had four family get-togethers where four of our Suzuki families would get together and all the kids would play. We'd play Capture the Flag outside in the afternoon on a Saturday afternoon once a month, go in, have dinner. We would program our own recital with each of us, play in whoever's living room we were at. And then we'd play our little recital in whatever order. I remember being under the dining table, like handwriting out the program and the order in which, you know, Jay, you're going first with La Folia. Okay, I'll go second with the Swan. Who's got something fast to follow the Swan? Okay, and then we'll all do a big group thing at the end after all 10 of the kids have played. Mm-hmm. And so it was just fun. And all of these opportunities for green lights happened in each of the kind of arenas in which I was studying at Waldorf School. It was all just, it was fun. It was intriguing. It was just, I want to learn more. And okay, well now I'll study music. I'll audition for music conservatories. And that all worked out fine. But I always knew I wanted to know, I always want to learn more. It doesn't stop for me. I'm a forever student. Okay, I'll stop.
I'll never stop, but I'll stop. You know, I love all of that. You are a forever student. You're also, there's a little bit of there's a curiosity there. There's a playfulness there. Mm-hmm. These are characteristics, traits I see in virtually all highly creative people, highly successful creative people. There was this my favorite cellist besides my grandfather is Jacqueline Dupre.
Yes.
And there's such a childlike, well, I am thinking about her age 16 performance, you know, you know, with Barenboim conducting, which is a little interesting that they ended up getting together.
Yeah.
But we won't go there. It's just interesting. You know, there's this like childlike wonder and excitement and I've seen you play too, and I see something similar. So do you think that's kind of an essential part of being a creative musician? Whatever that is, whatever that essence is.
I wouldn't call myself a creative musician. I would call my brother a creative musician, because they in Time for Three, which is two violins and a double bass, and just yesterday we saw them play their concerto with the Baltimore Symphony, the same concerto that we Philadelphia Orchestra recorded with them, and they won a Grammy for. Nicholas, my brother, has a playfulness And he does amazing improvisation. He's great with just hearing where something needs to be, where like musically speaking, this needs to have a jam in it, just like this rhythmic section coming along here. His whole group is super, super adept at that. And I certainly could learn the language as he is, but he never had any formal training in this. He's just been drumming his whole life in the basement, driving us nuts with upturned trash cans, and then climbing the streets of Philly outside Curtis, like banging on the lampposts with sticks as drumming. And I mean, he is, if you think I'm creative, Nicholas is oodles more what I would call creative. But I think to your point, playfulness and curiosity, which I think I do as a personality embody, I do feel like those help me continue to keep learning and growing myself. I'm not done, never finished. And, you know, interviews when I first got into the orchestra, I was 22 when I won the job. I finished Curtis and I started when I was 23. And I had some interviews like, what do you do now that you've reached the top and you're 23? You know, but this is always just the beginning. As soon as we think of ourselves as a finished product, which society often treats us as consumers and we're just supposed to absorb things and churn them out. But I think the human experience is about varieties of interaction and creativity, of interaction with creativity. And it's our opportunities and it's the tools that we're given that can cultivate our creativity. So I haven't had less. I don't feel like, to compare with my brother in improvisation, specifically in music, he is easily a stronger improvisation, like just jam, hands down, than me. Mm-hmm. I'm really good at interpreting classical music that somebody else has written. Nicholas is really excellent at generating music on the spot. I'm also capable of generating music. It takes me longer. Mm-hmm. But the time, if we're not constrained by time, then the whole concept of creativity for me does change. Because like Adam Grant says with precrastination, you know, everything that gels in our minds sometimes needs time. Maybe if we have a conversation again when I'm 50 or 60 and we'll see when I'm not so sleep deprived, there are other things that grow.
Gotcha. What are your top character strengths then? I don't want to put words in your mouth.
I have my top character strengths from 5 years ago. Zest, hope, and kindness. And zest has consistently, meaning enthusiasm or enthusiasm for life. Zest has consistently been in the top.
That's what I was commenting on. The zest I see when you play. It's wonderful. You've described the experience of playing in an orchestra as being engulfed in the chasmere of sound. It's a very poetic description, like you're wrapped in a beautiful blanket. Do you still feel that? Does that never cease? That feeling never cease?
That depends on what piece and, of course, what ensemble. But yes, with the Philadelphia Orchestra, I feel like sound is texture. Sound is feeling. Like, I mean, feeling on my skin. Like how soft cashmere feels is how that's my experience. That's my lived experience playing in the Philadelphia Orchestra. It is like sitting on your favorite couch and it just envelops you and you are covered up in your favorite blanket or your favorite cozy fuzzy, if that is your texture of choice. But it feels so right. And I'm so grateful every day that I get to go to work or as Amy Wojcicki would say, it's my calling. I feel like I get to do what I'm supposed to be doing.
It's your calling.
I call it work because it's functionally, that's what it is. But it is, I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing. And I feel so fortunate to be able to do that. Is it challenging some days? Yes. Is it also rewarding while also being challenging? Yes. Socially and also musically, meaning there are interactions, you know, with any workplace or group of a social network, we need to work things out. And that's rewarding as well as it is to make the music sitting on stage. I still remember the very first day that I substituted as a student after winning an audition to be able to do that. And that lit my fire even more, that when the audition would happen, I said, oh my gosh, if I could do this every day, I would take it in a heartbeat. And what a blessing it is to get to do that. I was sandwiched at the back of the cello section in front of the double basses. So I was in the low dark chocolate register of the taste buds, like 67% dark chocolate is my favorite chocolate. And I get to live
that.
Yeah,
I love it. You do. You do. There is a transcendence there. There is the talk about transcendent experience. There's something that just transcends any individual ideology or belief system. I mean, everyone in that room can feel that, feel the chills.
Yes.
The aesthetic chills. You've talked about tears of transcendence. Do you ever experience that while you're performing?
I did. I actually talked about that with Dacher Keltner a little bit. Yeah, from awe and these tingling, the chills that happen. One of those was I cried in a performance of a Mozart Requiem, and we performed it at Saratoga Springs, and I think I was crying because it brought me back to the week that my grandfather, the John Kendall Suzuki grandfather, that he died in January of 2011. And at work that week in January 2011, we also played Mozart's Requiem. Hmm. And for me, there is a connection in time between myselves from the 2019 version of the Mozart Requiem at Saratoga to the 2011 version of the Mozart's Requiem that we performed in Verizon Hall when grandfather died, and to honor him. I was playing it that week to honor him. Nobody else needed to know that. That was my own personal avenue of delivery in our performances that week. And so when I ended up crying in that 2019 version in Saratoga, I was doing a lot of internal reflection and transportation of my sort of inner self, of sadness, of grief, of anger, of also the musical anger that happens in Confutatis, in the specific movement with dum bum 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 bum. It's a very angry movement. Yeah. And so that helped conjure my own emotional connection to that with the many layers of my own personal experience. So that had, you know, grandfather's death, grief, the beauty of the piece itself, just separate from me personally, to transcending time with myself from my current then to the past self, sort of reliving some of the grief that I felt, or maybe unacknowledged grief that was coming out 8 years later. So there were a lot of layers in all of that that I live when I perform a piece. I'm thinking about my past self that introduced, that first met a piece of music, that same piece of music, to my current self, to sharing, of course, with the audience. Somebody in the audience is a grandfather. They're living it for the first time, or sadly, maybe the last time. Maybe they don't know it. So there are a lot of emotional connections for me in any given performance week, but that particular one, the tears of transcendence, for me, that was really specific to that piece and those moments in time that I was just describing. Does that make sense?
Oh, it makes so much sense. Okay.
Sometimes I don't know if what I'm saying is just gibberish. It's my lived experience, though, so it is to me.
Yeah,
what it is.
Yeah. you know, I think we can all kind of apply that experience to whatever it is we do when we feel like we're having a peak experience for what we're doing. Mm-hmm. You know, the peak experiences are pretty universal in their manifestations.
Yeah.
And that's what we should be doing, right? Is helping people find their own unique pathway to peak experience.
Yes.
I mean, I think I know you're really interested in excellence. And, you know, I think sometimes we make too much of excellence as being the goal, you know, as opposed to just self-actualization.
Yes.
What do you think about that?
I love that, because the striving, as we have a saying from one of my mentors at Curtis, the music is always better than it can be played.
Mm.
There is a constant striving in, specifically for me as a musician. I'm never good enough. I don't mean that in a downplay. I mean that in a sense of being humble and inspired at the same time to continue to grow. And so the constant striving is for me what this reaching our potential, yes, but also continuing to grow our potential. Because like I said, I don't stop learning. Mm-hmm. So we just keep growing. We just keep growing, keep being curious, keep being interested in things beyond ourselves that challenge us, that push me, that interest me. When I had the baby, I really couldn't do anything else. So that was kind of a fermata, a pause button with self-compassion, because we need the ebbs and flows of life. Or if someone has a grieving time, or definitely, all of these, you know, the ebb and flow of life happens. But when we're able, I put my foot on the accelerator, not in terms of, I shouldn't say accelerator. I fuel myself with the nutrients for growth. That's what I should say, because accelerator sounds like it's externally motivated and I want to be fast. And that's not how I think of reaching or continuing to strive for knowing our potential and seeing it. There's so much there, Scott.
There's a lot. Yes. There is, and I mean, I mean, on one level, I'm like, of course, with you on the constant growing. Growth is so important, but I guess I'm trying to say also that I think it's like okay sometimes to reach a happy place, even for a moment, where you're allowed to just enjoy what the journey that you've been on, and to just not have the pressure to like grow.
Absolutely.
Like, can't you have like a year of no growth?
Exactly.
but cultivation.
Well, I guess we know from
appreciation.
Of course. I mean, the peacefulness and the self-reflection that we need to just live like that. So two thoughts. Right. One is in biology, like physiologically, we need sleep to grow.
Mm-hmm.
If we don't sleep, your brain can't regenerate and grow and just be. True. So we need to sleep. In that sense, there's a metaphorical validation for what you're saying. And I totally agree with that from a lived experience as well. I can't, if I don't sleep, if I don't let myself rest, if I don't pause, then how do you refuel? That's my,
right.
And that's the big, and even in nature, in the season, of course, we are natural beings. In nature, we have, in the tropics anyway, we have the seasons where there's hibernation. The bear is going to hibernation. The plants, at least here in Pennsylvania, the leaves fall off the trees. The wind, the nature goes to sleep for the new springtime. And I think this is also Waldorf, like immersion in nature and appreciation for and connection to nature, I think is a key part of our understanding ourselves and how we work.
Totally.
That's totally agreeing with what you're saying about that need to reset, reflect,
be.
And just,
we'll just be.
Yeah. We're human beings. We're not human doers. We're human beings. That's first, right?
That's so right. Yeah.
I'm preaching to somebody today who is waiting for God to give you your next step. And you don't know what it is yet. You need God to show you your next step. Because God, I can't stay where I am like I am where it is. This isn't going to work. I have to move on, but I don't know where. A lot of time you'll use it as an excuse. Well, I don't know how. I don't know where. I don't know what. God, if you show me. God, if you tell me. God, if no. You know enough right now. And if you needed to know more, he would show you.
Hey, this is Stephen Furtick. I want to invite you to listen to my podcast, Elevation with Stephen Furtick. I am here to help you for the battles that you face in life, for the times when you feel discouraged, for the times that you need guidance from God. I want to give you the truth of what he says about you to help you rise to your full potential. Listen to Elevation with Stephen Furtick every Sunday and Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Hannah Storm, and my podcast, NBA DNA with Hannah Storm, digs deep into the history of professional basketball, along with my own as one of the first female sportscasters.
Now let's get you up to speed on what else happened around the NBA today.
We talked to all sorts of people I interacted with, from Dr. J to Charles Barkley, and recap iconic moments.
Yes, he's got it. Here he comes. Ray rock the baby to sleep and slam dunk.
As well as some of the wild stories behind the scenes.
We were like, what? What are we in for? The scoreboard crashes before we even tip a game off.
Today, the NBA is a global sports and entertainment giant. Players are multimillionaires and cultural icons.
Iguodala to Curry, back to Iguodala, up for the layup. Oh, blocked by James! LeBron James!
And these stories are about how we got here, both on and off the court. And what's next? Listen to NBA DNA with Hannah Storm on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. New year, new name, new energy, but...
same old us.
Oh, yeah.
And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. But that's not all. We will also have special guests to add their thoughts on the topics, as well as break down different political issues with local activists in their community. If you like to be informed, and to expand your thoughts, listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Because I just think there's such an emphasis on excellence, even in like music conservatories, and it's just a lot of people get burnt, a lot of musicians get burnt out, you know, and end up not even enjoying it anymore. I've seen that before.
Yes, I'm doing some coaching, I'm teaching, and of course that's often one of the most important topics is actually balancing towards that self-compassion and just being enjoying, remember why we're connected to this in the first place, or even just take a break. Yeah, that's just so important to our ability to, and that's, yeah, being able to be like a rubber or resilience and being able to go back and forth, breathe in, breathe out. These are all like the rhythm, the circadian rhythms of life. We need to emulate that. Absolutely. In fact, I wonder if there's studies on excellence without sleep. Like you can't, or the equivalent, the analogy, the equivalent of sleep and rest.
Yeah, I mean, Erickson, a lot of people quote his 10-year, 10,000 hours or 10 years to excellence. What they don't cite as much is that those who were the most accomplished musicians were those who had the most amount of downtime.
Yeah.
People don't cite that as much as the other finding.
Yeah.
You're very multifaceted in your interest in lots of things. You got this master's of applied positive psychology, which is where I met you at Penn.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that you're really interested in classical music's role in human flourishing and the importance of cultivating healthy organizations as pathways to serve the arts and public community. Where's your thinking these days around how we can cultivate healthy organizations? I know this is a deep passion of yours.
Wow. Thank you for asking. Interestingly, the reason I found MAP, the Applied Positive Psychology program at Penn, was because the Philadelphia Orchestra went through a pretty traumatizing Chapter 11 bankruptcy about 15 years ago, 14 years ago. And I felt helpless. And I don't like feeling helpless. I like to know what I can do to help. I like to know how I can contribute, how I can participate. And we were still playing. We played all our concerts. We didn't, we had to, the organization had to restructure for its long-term health. So I'm not going to discuss disagreeing or agreeing with the actual decision to go through that process, except to say from an experience point of view for the musicians, it was very traumatizing. And I found myself at the then Barnes & Noble at the corner of 18th and Walnut in Philly, in Center City, at the Barnes & Noble in the business section, looking at a lot of red books like power and leadership, authority, you know, because I was looking at what do other organizations do when they go through a struggle? We can't be the only ones who are facing a challenge. What do other people do when they're struggling with motivation or employee connection and all of these? I loved it. I just soaked up as much as I could. And I read specifically two books whose authors I ended up writing. Dan Pink's book called Drive, subtitled The Surprising Truth of Intrinsic Motivation. And then Adam Grant's book, Give and Take. And I wrote both of them. And very brief emails saying hi and thanks. And do you have any knowledge of application of your research to the classical music industry? Blah, blah, blah. I'm in the orchestra. Adam Grant, I wrote on a Sunday evening at like 11 p.m., hit send. And at 7:21, I got the auto reply, like very excellently written, beautiful auto reply. And then like a minute later, got a personal reply from Adam Grant, CCing me into the directors at the Positive Psychology Center, saying, there's a bunch of interaction here, intersection here that might be interesting. And literally 10 days later, this was December 28th, so no, it was about 14 days later, the MAP class, the Penn class in positive psychology, came to a Philadelphia Orchestra concert.
Wow.
And then the roof just blew off with all the connections there, because I met James, I met them backstage. We chatted. Wow. They invited me to come the next morning, Sunday morning at like 8 a.m. to Penn to help the class debrief their concert experience, which for many of them was their first classical music experience. And that for me was the beginning of everything MAP for the Applied Positive Psychology program. So to go back to your original question, I believe that healthy arts organizations, healthy nonprofit organizations that deliver public goods like arts, if those are, we can only be as good as our arts organization is, right? The organization needs to run well in order to be able to be effective for the public good. And so I feel like the healthier, the more we know about positive psychology and its possible applications to arts organizations, the healthier we can be and the more effective we can be in our delivery, in our concerts, we're already pouring our hearts out on stage as musicians. But from the patron experience to programming to EDI efforts that we're doing, you know, making strides on in an otherwise very antiquated industry, and antiquated because of its history in Western Europe aristocracy. And so this was the original sort of nucleus connection to positive psychology and the program at Penn. And while I have not officially applied it back to the Philadelphia Orchestra, I feel that the organization has, for a variety of reasons, grown and flourished in ways, maybe it's from post-traumatic growth, maybe it's from just being aware of the possibilities, but we have definitely grown from the challenges of before, and artistically, at least with the leadership of Yannick, our music director, we are we are just poised evermore for continued beloved representation and delivery of arts, messengers of music to Philadelphia and the country and internationally on tours. But that's the, anyway, that's the answer to that question, is that's where it stems from. My belief in strengthening arts organizations was that serendipitous email exchange with Adam Grant. Adam, thank you.
I'll share this episode with him. And also I'll share this episode with Dan Pink. Oh, but did Dan not respond?
No, Dan did not respond. I got the auto reply and then like the possibility that I'm in like 3 months I might get a reply or something, but that never happened.
He's usually really good at that. I'll say I'll stand up for Dan Pink for a second. He's, you know, when he has time. Very cool. I mean, I could talk to you all day. But I want to be respectful of your time. Let's just end with just give me a little bit of an idea of how having a child has enriched your life and has it changed your music at all?
Becoming a parent has been the most humbling experience and also the most rewarding experience. Well, right now I'm actually having a hard time with practicing at home because Phoebe stays awake when I practice and she wants to hear. She says, Mama, are you going to play the Dvorak now? Oh, was that the Brahms? Were you practicing the Brahms Requiem? She's so verbal and so much interaction and so much attention to what I'm practicing that I become aware that I'm keeping her awake, actually, or keeping her away from her things. So, and she wants to sit right next to me when I practice. And she also just started cello. So there's a lot of things that are happening. She wanted to start cello because I think she wanted to imitate me, which of course makes sense as a parent, and our connection is great. But it's been definitely a challenging thing to manage practice time from a practical standpoint. Emotionally, sense of meaning has skyrocketed because I just have
beautiful.
A deeper sense of being, of my why is for her.
Wow.
Yeah, there's a lot more there in the parent aspect and being a performing musician and managing time and all of this, but I know all parents go through this in some degree.
That getting outside of yourself aspect of human experience through your music, through children, through, you know, it looks like you're hitting transcendence on multiple fronts. I always find talking to you a transcendent experience. Yumi, thank you so much for being so gracious with your time today and for being on my show.
Thank you so much for having me, Scott, and for you, for all of your work. I've enjoyed reading your books about thinking about your perspective and your experience and how you're making the world a better place based on your experience and what you've been through. You're an incredible inspiration for education, for psychology, and for the human experience. So thank you for being who you are.
Every family has an origin story, one passed down through the generations. Mine happens to be a mystery involving my great-great-grandmother left behind in Sicily. I'm Joe Piazza, and my new podcast will transport you to the gorgeous island of Sicily as I trace my roots back through a whodunit for the ages. Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The world is full of magic and wonder, if you know where to look. And I'm obsessed with looking for it. I'm Simon Sinek, and I host a podcast called A Bit of Optimism. Each week, I have a short conversation with someone who inspires me or teaches me something about life, leadership, and other curious things. I hope you'll join me on the journey. Listen to A Bit of Optimism on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
I am so excited about this podcast, The Bright Side. You guys are giving people a chance to shine a light on their lives, shine a light on a little advice that they want to share.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.